things. Unfortunately for us, they were wrong. So we are left standing there in the woods with our uneasiness and our disgust, and disgust's boon companion, shame. I mentioned earlier that I had not registered any such emotion in the moments after shooting my pig, but eventually it dawned, or fell on me, like a great and unexpected weight. It happened late that evening, when back at home I opened my email and saw that Angelo had sent me some digital pictures under the subject heading, "Look, the Great Hunter." I was eager to open them, excited to show my family my pig, since it hadn't come home with me, but was hanging in Angelo's walk-in cooler. The image that appeared on my computer screen hit me like an unexpected blow to the body. A hunter in an orange sweater was kneeling on the ground behind a pig the side of whose head has erupted in blood that is spreading like a river delta toward the bottom of the frame. The hunter's rifle is angled just so across his chest. Clearly he is observing some hoary convention of the hunter's trophy portrait. One proprietary hand rests on the dead animal's broad flank. The man is looking into the camera with an expression of unbounded pride, wearing a big, shit-eating grin that might have been winning, if perhaps incomprehensible, had the bloodied carcass sprawled beneath him been cropped out of the frame. But the bloodied carcass was right there, front and center, and it rendered that grin. There's no other word for it, obscene. I felt as though I had stumbled on some stranger's pornography. I hurried my mouse to the corner of the image and clicked, closing it as quickly as I could. No one should ever see this. What could I possibly have been thinking? What was the man in that picture feeling? I couldn't for the life of me explain what could have inspired such a mad grin. It seemed so distant and alien from me now. If I didn't know better, I would have said that the man in the picture was drunk. And perhaps he was, captured in the throes of some sort of Dionysian intoxication, the bloodlust that Ortega says will sometimes overtake the successful hunter. And what was I so damn proud of anyway? I'd killed a pig with a gun. Big deal. Like the mirror in the convenience store earlier that afternoon, Angelo's digital photo had shown me the hunt and the hunter from the outside, subjecting it to a merciless gaze that hunting can't withstand, at least not in the 21st century. Yet I'm not prepared to say that that gaze offers the more truthful view of the matter. The picture is a jolting dispatch from the deep interior of an experience that does not easily travel across the borders of modern life. Angelo's pictures, there were more, and eventually I looked at them all, resemble in certain respects the trophy photos sent home by soldiers, who shock their brides and mothers with images of themselves grinning astride the corpses of the enemy dead. They are entitled to their pride. Killing is precisely what we've asked them to do, and yet do we really have to look at the pictures? I've looked at Angelo's pictures again, trying to figure out why they should have shamed me so. I realize it isn't the killing they record that I felt ashamed of, not exactly, but the manifest joy I seem to be feeling about what I'd done. This, for many people, is what is most offensive about hunting. To some, disgusting. That it encourages or allows us not only to kill, but to take a certain pleasure in killing. It's not as though the rest of us don't countenance the killing of tens of millions of animals every year. Yet for some reason we feel more comfortable with the mechanical killing practiced out of view and without emotion by industrial agriculture. Perhaps there is a more generous light in which to regard the hunter's joy. Perhaps it is the joy of a creature succeeding at something he has discovered his nature has superbly equipped him to do, an action that is less a perversion of that nature, his creaturely character, than a fulfillment of it. But what of the animal in the picture? Well, the animal, too, has had the chance to fulfill its wild nature, has lived, and arguably even died, in a manner consistent with its creaturely character. Hers is, by the standards of animal death, a good one. But could I really say that yet? What if it turned out I couldn't eat this meat? I realized that the drama of the hunt doesn't end until the animal arrives at the table. For one creature to mourn the death of another is a new thing under the sun, wrote Aldo Leopold, himself a deeply conflicted hunter. It is a very good thing indeed, he suggests, but we would do well to recognize just how new it is, what a departure from the usual order of nature this mourning represents. What shames at least some of us about hunting is the same thing that shames us about every other reminder of our origins. That is, the incompleteness of our transcendence of our animal nature. So which view of me, the hunter, is the right one? The shame at the photograph or the joy of the man in it? The outside gaze or the inside one? The moralist is eager to decide this question once and for all, to join Cotton Mather in his noble quest for a more complete transcendence. The hunter, or at least the grown-up hunter, the uneasy hunter, recognizes the truths disclosed in both views, which is why his joy is tempered by shame, his appetite shadowed by disgust. The fact that you cannot come out of hunting feeling unambiguously good about it is perhaps what should commend the practice to us. You certainly don't come out of it eager to protest your innocence. If I've learned anything about hunting and eating meat, it's that it's even messier than the moralist thinks. Having killed a pig and looked at myself in that picture, and now looking forward, if that's the word, to eating that pig, I have to say there is a part of me that envies the moral clarity of the vegetarian, the blamelessness of the tofu eater. Yet part of me pities him, too. Dreams of innocence are just that. They usually depend on a denial of reality that can be its own form of hubris. Ortega suggests that there is an immorality in failing to look clearly at reality, or in believing that the sheer force of human will can somehow overcome it. The preoccupation with what should be is estimable only when the respect for what is has been exhausted. What is? I suppose that this, as much as anything else, as much as a pig or a meal, is what I was really hunting for, and what I returned from my hunt with a slightly clearer sense of. What is not an answer to anything exactly. It doesn't tell you what to do or even what to think. Yet respect for what is does point us in a direction. That direction just happens to be the direction from which we came. To that place and time, I mean, where humans looked at the animals they killed, regarded them with reverence, and never ate them except with gratitude. There was one other picture in Angelo's email that I didn't look at very closely until some time later, no doubt because it hadn't hit me over the head the way the trophy portrait had. This was the picture I took of Angelo cleaning my pig when I needed to break away. It's a straightforward snapshot of the pig hanging from the tree, but taken from a sufficient distance that you can see in that one frame the animal and the butcher and the oak tree against the sun-filled sky and the pig plowed earth, sloping down to a brook below. You can't make out the buzzing yellow jackets or the turkey vultures doing lazy circles overhead, or the acorns littering the ground, but I realized that here in this single picture you could actually observe this food chain in its totality, the entire circuit of energy and matter that had created the pig we were turning into meat for our meal. For there was the oak tree standing in the sun, light which it had transformed into the acorns that littered the ground and fed the pig that the man in the picture was turning into food. The man had done nothing to create this food chain, only stepped into a role prepared long ago for the predator. And whatever of this prey the man left behind, the other animals here, the scavengers, would in due course fold back into the earth, nourishing the oak so that it might in turn nourish another pig. Sun, soil, oak, pig, human. There it was. One of the food chains that have sustained life on Earth for a million years made visible in a single frame. One uncluttered and most beautiful example of what is. Chapter 19. Gathering. The Fungi. Isn't it curious how in so many of our pastimes and hobbies we play at supplying one or another of our fundamental creaturely needs? For food, shelter, even clothing? So some people knit, others build things or chop wood, and a great many of us work at feeding ourselves, by gardening or hunting, fishing or foraging. An economy organized around a complex division of labor can usually get these jobs done for a fraction of the cost, in time or money, that it takes us to do them ourselves. Yet something in us apparently seeks confirmation that we still have the skills needed to provide for ourselves. You know, just in case. Evidently, we want to be reminded how the fundamental processes that sustain us, by now hidden behind a globe-spanning scrim of economic complexity, actually work. It may be little more than a conceit at this point, but we like to think of ourselves as self-reliant, even if only for a few hours on the weekend, even when growing the stuff yourself winds up costing twice as much as it would to buy it at the store. Playing at self-reliance takes different forms in different people, and you can probably tell a lot about a person by his choice of atavism. Whether he's drawn to the patient and solitary attentiveness of fishing, the strict mathematical syntax of building, the emotional drama of the hunt, or the mostly comic dialogue with other species that unfolds in the garden. Most of us have a pretty good idea which of these jobs we'd try for if somehow a time machine were to plunk us down in the Pleistocene or Neolithic. At least until my adventures in hunting and gathering, I'd always thought of myself as a Neolithic kind of guy. Growing food has been my atavism of choice since I was 10 years old, when I planted a farm in my parents' suburban yard and set up a farm stand patronized pretty much exclusively by my mother. The mysteries of germination and flowering and fruiting engaged me from an early age, and the fact that by planting and working an ordinary patch of dirt you could, in a few months' time, harvest things of taste and value was, for me, nature's most enduring astonishment. It still is. Gardening is a way of being in nature, steeped in assumptions of which the gardener is seldom more than vaguely aware, if at all. To work exclusively with domesticated species, for example, is bound to color your view of nature as being a fairly benign place, one that answers to human desires for beauty, for tastiness. In the garden, you will also, understandably, come to think of whatever grows there as belonging to you, since it is more or less the product of your labors performed on your land. And you will regard the wilder, less tractable residents of your garden, the ones you didn't invite, as pests. The other. The gardener is a confirmed dualist, dividing his work into crisp categories. Cultivated land and wilderness, domestic and wild species, mine and theirs, home and away. The gardener, like the farmer, lives in a well-marked and most legible world. I hadn't actually thought about the gardener's worldview in this light till I'd spent some time mushroom hunting, which proposes a whole other way of being in nature. Hunting for mushrooms is an operation that superficially resembles harvesting. You're looking around in nature for the ready-to-eat, yet you quickly discover that the two activities could hardly be more different. For starters, mushrooms are usually hunted in an unfamiliar place where you stand a very good chance of getting lost, particularly since you are looking down at the ground so determinedly the whole time. Getting lost just isn't much of a problem in the garden, which is why gardeners looking to create that experience plant mazes. And whereas in your garden the ready-to-eat tomato beckons to you, flashing red from out of the undifferentiated green, mushrooms definitely hide. Picking and eating the wrong ones could get you killed, too, something not easily done in the garden. No, gratifying human needs and desires is just not what mushrooms are about. Mushrooms, you soon discover, are wild things in every way, beings pursuing their own agenda quite apart from ours. Which is why hunting, rather than harvesting, is the mycophile's preferred term of art. Five Chanterelles. It was a Sunday morning in late January when I got the call from Angelo. "The chanterelles are up," he announced. How do you know? Have you been out looking? No, not yet. But it's been 3 weeks since the big rains. We'd had a torrential week between the holidays. They're up now, I'm sure of that. We should go tomorrow. At the time, I barely knew Angelo. We had yet to go pig hunting, which made his invitation to come mushrooming with him all the more generous. Mushroom hunters are famously protective of their spots, and a good chanterelle spot is a precious personal possession, though not quite as precious as a good porcini spot. Before Angelo agreed to take me, I'd asked a slew of acquaintances I knew to be mycophiles if I might accompany them. The Bay Area is home to many such people, probably because mushroom hunting marries the region's two guiding obsessions, eating and the outdoors. I was always careful to solemnly swear to protect the location of their spots. For some people, you could see at once that this was an entirely outrageous request, tantamount to asking if I might borrow their credit card for the afternoon. Others reacted more calmly, yet always cagily. Angelo's friend Jean-Pierre is reputed to have good chanterelle spots right within the Berkeley city limits, but he repeatedly found polite ways to deflect my entreaties into the distant future. Several mushroom hunters responded to my request with the same joke. Sure, you can come mushroom hunting with me, but I must tell you that immediately afterward I will have to kill you. What you fully expect to follow such a jokey warning, a warning I always parried with an offer to wear a blindfold coming and going, is some sort of conditional invitation, but it never arrives. Without ever exactly saying no, the mushroom hunter will deftly beg off or change the subject. I thought maybe the problem was that I was a writer, somebody who might do something as crazy as publish the location of a favorite spot, so I emphasized that a journalist would sooner go to jail than reveal a secret from a confidential source. This swayed precisely no one. I was beginning to think it was hopeless, that I was going to have to learn to hunt mushrooms from books, a dubious, not to mention dangerous, proposition. And then Angelo called. Though I probably shouldn't overstate Angelo's generosity. The place he took me mushrooming was on private and gated land owned by an old friend of his, so it wasn't as though he was giving away the family jewels. The property was a vineyard outside of Glen Ellen, with several hundred untended acres of oak chaparral stretching to the northeast toward St. Helena. As soon as you stepped out of the manicured vineyard, the land relaxed into gently rolling savanna, with broad, sloping passages of grass, verdant after the winter rains, punctuated by shady groves of live oak and bay laurel. The chanterelle is a mycorrhizal species, which means it lives in association with the roots of plants. Oak trees, in the chanterelle's case, and usually oak trees of a venerable age. Though there must have been hundreds of promisingly ancient oaks here, Angelo, who had been hunting chanterelles on the property for years, seemed to be on a first-name basis with every one of them. "That one there is a producer," he'd tell me, pointing across the meadow with his forked walking stick to an unremarkable tree. "But the one next to it, I never once found a mushroom there." I cut my own walking stick from an oak branch and set off across the meadow to hunt beneath the tree Angelo had declared a good producer. He had instructed me to use the stick to turn over the leaf litter wherever it seemed uplifted. The stick also would carry spores from one tree to another, Angelo explained. Evidently he regarded himself as something of a bumblebee to the chanterelles, transporting their genes from tree to tree. In general, mushroom hunters view their role in nature as benign. I looked around my tree for a few minutes, walking a stooped circle under its drip line, flicking the leaf litter here and there with my stick, but I saw nothing. Eventually, Angelo came over and pointed to a spot no more than a yard from where I stood. I looked, I stared, but still saw nothing but a chaotic field of tan leaves and tangled branches. Angelo got down on his knees and brushed the leaves and soil away to reveal a bright, squash-colored trumpet the size of his fist. He cut it at the base with a knife and handed it to me. The mushroom was unexpectedly heavy and cool to the touch. How in the world had he spotted it? The mushroom hadn't even peeked up from the leaf litter yet. Apparently, you had to study the leaves for subtle signs of hydraulic lift from below, and then look at the ground sideways, because the fat gold shafts of the chanterelles often reveal themselves before their tops break through the leaves. Yet when Angela pointed to another spot under the same tree, a spot where he had obviously seen another mushroom, I was still blind. Not until he had shuffled the leaves with the tip of his stick did the golden nugget of fungus flash at me. I became convinced that Angelo had some other sense working for him besides sight, that he must be smelling the chanterelles before looking down to see them. But that's apparently how it goes with hunting mushrooms. You have to get your eyes on, as hunters will sometimes put it. And after following Angelo around for a while, I did begin to get my eyes on, a little, though at first, oddly enough, this would only happen when I was in Angelo's presence, working the same oak tree. Other novices talk about this phenomenon, and I suspect it's a little like the trick of the counting horse, who is not really doing arithmetic, as it appears, but is merely picking up subtle clues in the body language of its trainer. Wherever Angelo lingered, wherever the beams of his gaze raked the ground with particular intensity, I would look and occasionally would see. I was the horse who could count, the man who could find a chanterelle using someone else's eyes. But before the morning was out, I'd begun to find a few chanterelles on my own. I began to understand what it meant to have my eyes on, and the chanterelles started to pop out of the landscape, one and then another, almost as though they were beckoning to me. So had I stumbled on a particularly good spot, or had I learned at last how to see them? Nature or nurture? There was no way of telling, though I did have the eerie experience of resurveying the very same patch of ground and finding a Siamese pair of chanterelles, bright as double egg yolks, in a spot where a moment before I could swear there had been nothing but the tan carpet of leaves. Either they had just popped up, or visual perception is a lot more variable and psychological than we think. It is certainly ruled by expectation, because whenever I was convinced I was in a good spot, the mushrooms were more likely to appear. Seeing is believing has it backward when it comes to hunting mushrooms. In this case, believing is seeing. My ability to see mushrooms seemed to function less like a window than a tool, a constructed and wielded thing. After spotting a couple of nice ones, I developed a measure of confidence that ultimately proved to be unfounded. Based on my still modest scores, I worked out a snap theory of the good spot, which involved the optimal springiness of the soil and the distance from the trunk, but the theory didn't hold up. After a brief run of luck, I promptly went blind again and failed to find another mushroom all day. I would say there were no more mushrooms left to find, except that Angelo was still finding them under canopies I had supposedly exhausted. Not a lot. We were a few days early, he decided, but enough to fill a grocery bag. I had managed to find a total of 5, which doesn't sound like much, except that several of them weighed close to a pound each. My 5 chanterelles were tremendous, beautiful things I couldn't wait to taste. And that night, I did. I washed off the dirt, patted them dry, and then sliced the chanterelles into creamy white slabs. They smelled faintly of apricots, and I knew at once that this was the same mushroom I had found near my house, the one I had been afraid to taste. The squashy hue matched, and these had the same shallow gills, ridges, really, running up the stalk, which flared out to meet the gently infolded cap like a stout golden vase. I sautéed the chanterelles as Angelo had recommended, first in a dry frying pan to sweat out their water, which was copious, and then with butter and shallots. The mushrooms were delicious in a subtle way that could easily be overwhelmed or overlooked. They had a delicate flavor, fruity with a hint of pepper, and a firm but silky texture. You might reasonably ask if, eating my wild mushrooms, I felt the least bit concerned about waking up dead. Did I harbor any lingering doubts that these mushrooms were really chanterelles, edible delicacies and not some deadly poison Angelo had mistaken for chanterelles? An understandable question, yet oddly enough, in view of my mycophobic predilections, it was no longer an issue. Oh, maybe I felt the vaguest shadow of a doubt as I lifted the first forkful, but it was easily brushed aside. I trusted Angelo implicitly, and besides, these mushrooms smelled and tasted right. At dinner that night, we joked about mushroom poisoning, recalling the time Judith had stumbled upon a prodigious patch of morels while biking with her friend Christopher in Connecticut. She came home with a trash bag half full of them, an astounding haul. But I could not bring myself to serve the mushrooms until we could get some kind of confirmation that these were indeed morels and not, say, the false morels that the field guides warned against. But how to be sure? I couldn't quite trust the books, or at least my reading of them. The solution to the dilemma seemed obvious, if perhaps a little heartless. I proposed to Judith we put the morels in the refrigerator overnight and then give Christopher a call in the morning. Assuming he was sufficiently alive to answer his phone, he would undoubtedly mention whether he'd eaten the morels the previous night, and we would then know ours were safe to eat. I saw no reason to mention his role as an experimental human subject. Well, that's one way of dealing with the omnivore's dilemma. Wild mushrooms in general throw that dilemma into particularly sharp relief, since they confront us simultaneously with some of the edible world's greatest rewards and gravest risks. Arguably, mushroom eating poses the starkest case of the omnivore's dilemma, which could explain why people hold such strong feelings, pro or con, on the subject of wild mushrooms. As mycologists are fond of pointing out, you can divide most people, and even whole cultures, into mycophiles and mycophobes. Anglo-Americans are notoriously mycophobic, while Europeans and Russians tend to be passionate mycophiles, or so mushroomers will tell you. But I suspect most of us harbor both impulses in varying proportions, approaching the wild mushroom with a heightened sense of the omnivore's basic tension as we struggle to balance our adventurousness in eating against a protective fear, our neophilia against our neophobia. As the case of mushrooms suggests, the omnivore's dilemma often comes down to a question of identification, to knowing exactly what it is you are preparing to eat. From the moment Angelo handed me that first mushroom, what is and is not a chanterelle suddenly seemed as plain to me as sunshine. I knew right then that the next time I found a chanterelle anywhere, I would recognize it and not hesitate to eat it. Which is peculiar when you consider that in the case of the chanterelle I found in my neighborhood, a half dozen authoritative field guides by credentialed mycologists had failed to convince me beyond a reasonable doubt of something I now was willing to bet my life on, based on the say-so of one Sicilian guy with no mycological training whatsoever. How could that be? In deciding whether or not to ingest a new food, the omnivore will happily follow the lead of a fellow omnivore who has eaten the same food and lived to talk about it. This is one advantage we have over the rat, which has no way of sharing with other rats the results of his digestive experiments with novel foodstuffs. For the individual human, his community and culture successfully mediate the omnivore's dilemma, telling him what other people have safely eaten in the past, as well as how they ate it. Just imagine if we had to decide every such edibility question on our own. Only the bravest or most foolish of us would ever eat a mushroom. The social contract is a great boon to omnivores in general, and to mushroom eaters in particular. The field guides contain our culture's accumulated wisdom on the subject of mushrooms. Curiously, though, the process of imparting and absorbing this life-and-death information works much better in person than it does on paper, whether through writing or even photography. Andrew Weil discusses this phenomenon in a wonderful series of essays on mushrooms he's collected in a volume called The Marriage of the Sun and Moon. One learns most mushrooms in only one way, through people who know them. It is terribly difficult to do it from books, pictures, or written descriptions. I wonder if books fail us here because the teaching transaction, this one is good to eat, that one not, is so fundamental, even primordial, that we're instinctively reluctant to trust it to any communication medium save the oldest. That is, direct personal testimony from, to put it bluntly, survivors. After all, precisely what is meant by this one, the myriad qualities embedded in that modest little pronoun, can be conveyed only imperfectly in words and pictures. Our ability to identify plants and fungi with confidence, which after all is one of the most critical tools of our survival, involves far more sensory information than can ever be printed on a page. It is truly a form of body knowledge, not easily reduced or conveyed over a distance. But now that I have held a freshly picked chanterelle in my hands, smelled its apricotty scent, registered its specific heft and the precise quality of its cool dampness, and absorbed who knows how many other qualities beneath the threshold of conscious notice, I'll recognize the next one without a moment's hesitation. At least in the case of this one species, my mycophobic instinct has been stilled, allowing me to enjoy. It's not every day you acquire such a sturdy piece of knowledge. Mushrooms are mysterious. I put that knowledge to good use the following week, when I returned to the oak tree near my house and found beneath it a gold rush of chanterelles. I hadn't thought to bring a bag, and there were more chanterelles than I could carry, so I made a carrier of my t-shirt, folding it up in front of me like a basket, and then filled it with the big, mud-encrusted mushrooms. I drew looks from passers-by. Looks of envy, I decided, though at the time I was so excited I may have gotten that wrong. So now I have a spot, and just like Jean-Pierre's, it's right here in town. Please don't ask me where it is. I don't want to have to kill you. Once the rains stopped in April, the chanterelles were done for the year, and there wouldn't be another important mushroom to hunt until the morels came up in May. I used the time before then to read about mushrooms and talk to mycologists, hoping to answer some of the questions I had collected about fungi, a life form I was beginning to regard as deeply mysterious. What made mushrooms mushroom when and where they did? Why do chanterelles associate with oaks and morels with pines? Why under this tree and not that one? How long do they live? Why do some mushrooms manufacture deadly toxins, not to mention powerful hallucinogens and a range of delicious flavors? I brought the gardener's perspective to these plant-like objects, but of course they're not plants, and plant knowledge is all but useless in understanding fungi, which are in fact more closely related to animals than they are to plants. As it happens, the answers to most of my questions about mushrooms, even the most straightforward ones, are elusive. Indeed, it is humbling to realize just how little we know about this, the third kingdom of life on Earth. The books I consulted brimmed with confessions of their ignorance. It is not known why this should be. The number of genders among fungi is as yet undetermined. The exact mechanisms by which this phenomenon occurs are not entirely understood at this time. The fundamental chemistry responsible for the vivid hallucinations was a mystery then and remains so today. It is not certain whether the morel is a saprophytic or a mycorrhizal species, or perhaps it is both a changeling, and so on, through thousands of pages of the mycological literature. When I went to visit David Aurora, the renowned mycologist whose doorstep of a field guide, Mushrooms Demystified, is the West Coast Mushroomer's Bible, I asked him what he considered the big open questions in his field. Without a moment's hesitation, he named two. Why here and not there? Why now and not then? In other words, we don't know the most basic things about mushrooms. Part of the problem is simply that fungi are very difficult to observe. What we call a mushroom is only the tip of the iceberg of a much bigger and essentially invisible organism that lives most of its life underground. The mushroom is the fruiting body of a subterranean network of microscopic hyphae, improbably long root-like cells that thread themselves through the soil like neurons. Bunched like cables, the hyphae form webs of, still microscopic, mycelium. Mycologists can't dig up a mushroom like a plant to study its structure because its mycelium are too tiny and delicate to tease from the soil without disintegrating. Hard as it may be to see a mushroom, the most visible and tangible part, To see the whole organism of which it is merely a component may simply be impossible. Fungi also lack the comprehensible syntax of plants, the orderly and visible chronology of seed and vegetative growth, flower, fruit, and seed again. The fungi surely has a syntax of their own, but we don't know all its rules, especially the ones that govern the creation of a mushroom, which can take 3 years or 30, depending. On what? We don't really know. All of which makes mushrooms seem autochthonous, arising seemingly from nowhere, seemingly without cause. Fungi, lacking chlorophyll, differ from plants in that they can't manufacture food energy from the sun. Like animals, they feed on organic matter made by plants or by plant eaters. Most of the fungi we eat obtain their energy by one of two means: saprophytically, by decomposing dead vegetable matter, and mycorrhizally, by associating with the roots of living plants. Among the saprophytes, many of which can be cultivated by inoculating a suitable mass of dead organic matter, logs, manure, grain, with their spores, are the common white button mushrooms, shiitakes, cremini, portobellos, and oyster mushrooms. Most of the choicest wild mushrooms are impossible to cultivate, or nearly so, since they need living and often very old trees in order to grow, and can take several decades to fruit. The mycelium can grow more or less indefinitely, in some cases for centuries, without necessarily fruiting. A single fungus recently found in Michigan covers an area of 40 acres underground and is thought to be a few centuries old. So inoculating old oaks or pines is no guarantee of harvesting future mushrooms, at least not on a human timescale. Presumably, these fungi live and die on an arboreal timescale. Mycorrhizal fungi have co-evolved with trees, with whom they've worked out a mutually beneficial relationship in which they trade the products of their very different metabolisms. If the special genius of plants is photosynthesis, the ability of chlorophyll to transform sunlight and water and soil minerals into carbohydrates, the special genius of fungi is the ability to break down organic molecules and minerals into simple molecules and atoms through the action of their powerful enzymes. The hyphae surround or penetrate the plant's roots, providing them with a steady diet of elements in exchange for a drop of simple sugars that the plant synthesizes in its leaves. The network of hyphae vastly extends the effective reach and surface area of a plant's root system, and while trees can survive without their fungal associates, they seldom thrive. It is thought that the fungi may also protect their plant hosts from bacterial and fungal diseases. The talent of fungi for decomposing and recycling organic matter is what makes them indispensable, not only to trees but to all life on Earth. If the soil is the Earth's stomach, fungi supply its digestive enzymes. Literally. Without fungi to break things down, the Earth would long ago have suffocated beneath a blanket of organic matter created by plants. The dead would pile up without end, the carbon cycle would cease to function, and living things would run out of things to eat. We tend to train our attention in science on life and growth, but of course, death and decomposition are no less important to nature's operations, and the fungi are the undisputed rulers of this realm. That the fungi are so steeped in death might account for much of their mystery and our mycophobia. They stand on the threshold between the living and the dead, breaking the dead down into food for the living, a process on which no one likes to dwell. Cemeteries are usually good places to hunt for mushrooms. Mexicans call mushrooms carne de los muertos, flesh of the dead. The fact that mushrooms can themselves be direct agents of death doesn't exactly shine their reputation either. Just why they should produce such potent toxins isn't well understood. Many mycologists assume the toxins are defenses, but others point out that if poisoning the animals that eat you is such a good survival strategy, then why aren't all mushrooms poisonous by now? Some of their toxins may simply be fungal tools for doing what fungi do. breaking down complicated organic compounds. What the deadly Amanita does to a human liver is, in effect, to digest it from within. The evolutionary reason many mushrooms produce powerful hallucinogens is even more mysterious, though it probably has nothing to do with creating hallucinations in human brains. As the word intoxication implies, substances that poison the body sometimes can change consciousness too. This might explain why mycophiles think civilians make far too much of the dangers of mushrooms, which they see as occupying a continuum from the deadly to the really interesting. The dose makes the poison, as they say, and the same mushroom toxins that can kill can also, in smaller doses, produce astonishing mental effects, ranging from the ecstatic to the horrific. No doubt the mind-altering properties of many common mushrooms, known to people for thousands of years, have nourished the cult of mystery surrounding the fungal kingdom, in this case feeding both mycophobia and mycophilia alike. Andrew Weil points out an interesting paradox about mushrooms. It's difficult to reconcile the extraordinary energies of these organisms with the fact that they contain relatively little of the kind of energy that scientists usually measure, calories. Because they don't supply many calories, nutritionists don't regard mushrooms as an important source of nutrition. They do provide some minerals and vitamins, as well as a few essential amino acids, which are what give some species their meaty flavor. But calories are simply units of solar energy that have been captured and stored by green plants and, as Weil points out, mushrooms have little to do with the sun. They emerge at night and wither in the light of day. Their energies are of an entirely different order from those of plants, and their energies are prodigious and strange. Consider. There are fungi like the shaggy mane, Coprinus comatus, that can push their soft, fleshy tissue through asphalt. Inky caps, Coprinus atramentarius, can mushroom in a matter of hours and then, over the course of a day, dissolve themselves into a puddle of blackish ink. Oyster mushrooms, Pleurotus ostreatus, can digest a pile of petrochemical sludge in a fortnight, transforming the toxic waste into edible protein. This alchemy makes more sense when you recall that what saprophytic mushrooms have evolved to do is break down complex organic molecules, which is precisely what petrochemicals are. Jack-o'-lanterns, Omphalatus olivacens, can glow in the dark, emitting an eerie blue bioluminescence for reasons unknown. The psilocybes can alter the texture of human consciousness and inspire visions. Amanita muscaria can derange the mind. And, of course, there are the handful of fungi that can kill. We don't have the scientific tools to measure or even account for these fungi's unusual powers. Weil speculates that their energies derive from the moon rather than the sun, that mushrooms contain, instead of calories of solar origin, prodigious amounts of lunar energy. Okay. It is hard, I agree, to avoid the conclusion that some of the people who write about mushrooms have themselves partaken, perhaps immoderately, of the mind-altering kinds. Their reverence for their subject runs so deep that they will pursue it wherever it leads, even if that means occasionally leaping the fence of current scientific understanding. In the case of mushrooms, that's not a very tall or sturdy fence. A powerful and compelling strain of mysticism runs like branching mycelium through the mycological literature, where I encountered one incredible speculation after another. That the mycelium of fungi are literally neurons, together comprising an organ of terrestrial intelligence and communication, Paul Stamets. That the ingestion of hallucinogenic mushrooms by the higher primates spurred the rapid evolution of the human brain. Terence McKenna. That the hallucinogenic mushrooms ingested by early man inspired the shamanic visions that led to the birth of religion. Gordon Wasson. That the ritual ingestion of a hallucinogenic fungus, called ergot, by Greek thinkers, including Plato, at Eleusis, is responsible for some of the greatest achievements of Greek culture, including Platonic philosophy. Wasson again. That wild mushrooms in the diet, by nourishing the human unconscious with lunar energy, stimulate imagination and intuition. Andrew Weil. I'm not prepared to discount any of these speculations just because they're not provable by our science. Mushrooms are mysterious. Who's to say the day won't come when science will be able to measure the fungi's exotic energies? Perhaps even calculate our minimum daily requirement of lunar calories. Working the burn. After the first pig hunt, Jean-Pierre had driven me home, and I used the captive car time to probe him once again on the subject of mushrooms. He yielded no ground, but did mention a mushroom hunter by the name of Anthony Tazzanello, who had shown up at his restaurant earlier in the week with several pounds of morels. Jean-Pierre offered to put me in touch with Anthony. It is amazing the lengths to which some people will go to deflect attention from their own mushroom spots. True to his word, Jean-Pierre sent an email to Anthony, who expressed a willingness to take me morel hunting. I was surprised he'd let a complete stranger tag along, but after some back and forth by email, it began to make more sense. The morels were on, and Anthony could use an extra pair of hands, especially ones that were asking for nothing in return. As for concerns I might compromise his spots, I swore my usual oaths, the secrecy issue is not nearly so touchy in the case of the burn morels we would be hunting. These are morels that fruit in profusion the spring following a pine forest fire. Even if I were to disclose classified information, it would have little value beyond this spring. Indeed, beyond the next couple of weeks, since he fully expected the entire California mycological community to descend on this burn the moment the word got out. Anthony emailed that I should meet him in front of his house Friday morning at 6 a.m. sharp, warning me to come prepared for a harsh and unpredictable environment. We'll go rain, snow, or shine. Don't laugh. It has snowed once already this spring, and we managed to find morels poking through the accumulation. It wasn't fun, but memorable. The weather where we'll hunt can be very different from here, and even from the valley. We'll be hiking nearly a mile above sea level, and it can be hot, cold, or wet, all in a matter of hours. Bring light layers and rain gear just in case. A solid pair of hiking boots with ankle support is a must. It is very steep, rocky terrain with huge, burned, fallen trees and ground that is thoroughly soaked. Bring a hat. The sun is stronger at this elevation, plus it keeps cedar needles and spiderwebs out of your face and can double as a mushroom sack when your basket is full. Anthony also advised me to bring sunscreen and bug spray for mosquitoes, at least a gallon of water, chapstick, and, if I owned one, a walkie-talkie. Morel hunting didn't sound like much fun, more like survival training than a walk in the woods. I crossed my fingers that Anthony was just trying to scare me and set my alarm for 4:30 a.m., wondering why it is all these hunting-gathering expeditions had to begin at such ungodly hours in the morning. In the case of the pigs, I understood the need to be ready when the animals were still active early in the day, but it's not as though these morels were going anywhere after lunch. Perhaps when you're foraging, you just want as much daylight as possible. Or maybe we wanted the early start to beat competing foragers to the best spots. I pulled up to Anthony's curb a little before 6 to find 2 30-ish-looking men in rain slickers loading an SUV with enough materiel to provision a week-long campaign in hostile territory. Anthony was a rail-thin, angular 6-footer with a goatee in the style of Frank Zappa. His friend Ben Bailey was a somewhat rounder and softer man with an easy laugh. I learned on the long ride across the Central Valley that Anthony and Ben were childhood friends from Piscataway, New Jersey. After college, they'd both made the pilgrimage to the Bay Area to become chefs. Anthony had been working as a pastry chef at Chez Panisse when one afternoon a backwoodsy-looking fellow dressed in camouflage showed up at the kitchen door with crates of wild mushrooms. I loved to eat mushrooms, so I put it in his ear that I wanted to go out with him sometime, and eventually it happened. He took me up to Sonoma, and we found bolettes and chanterelles. We just went outside and found dinner. It was such a feeling of empowerment to feed yourself by figuring out the puzzle of nature. Anthony still works as a chef, mostly doing private dinners, which leaves many of his days free for mushroom hunting, usually with Ben, who also works as a chef. Anthony mentioned that we were going to be joined today by someone they'd met at the burn the week before, a young guy known to them only by his mycological handle, Polly Porcini. I gathered that Polly Porcini was part of the subculture of mushroom hunters who travel up and down the West Coast, following the seasonal fruiting of the fungi. Porcinis in the fall, chanterelles in winter, morels in the spring. These are people living out of vans, Ben explained, not the types who ever watch the 5 o'clock news. They cobble together a living selling their mushrooms to brokers who set up shop in motel rooms near the forests, post signs, and pay the hunters in cash. Anthony and Ben aren't really a part of this world. They hold jobs, live in houses, and sell their mushrooms directly to restaurants. We don't think of ourselves as professionals yet, Anthony said. End of Disc 12. We drove for several hours through the valley and then gradually ascended into the Sierra to El Dorado National Forest, a 1,200-square-mile swath of pine and cedar stretched between Lake Tahoe and Yosemite. As we climbed into the mountains, the temperature dropped down into the 30s, and a frozen rain began to pelt the windshield. Along the roadside, patches of old, dirty snow grew steadily larger and fresher until they expanded to cover everything. It was early May, but we had driven back into winter. The morels come up on pine firelands just as the snow cover retreats and the soil begins to warm. So after entering the burn area at about 5,000 feet, we descended along a logging road, looking for the frontier of white snow and blackened earth. At about 4,500 feet, we found it, a forbidding moonscape in black and white. We knew our altitude because Anthony and Ben, like many mushroom hunters these days, carry portable global positioning system, GPS locators, to mark good spots, calculate their altitude, and keep from getting lost. We parked the SUV and had an initial look around. Soon after, Polly Porcini appeared, a bearded, self-contained fellow in his 20s who carried a walking stick and had a bandana wrapped around his head. Polly, a man of few words, seemed like someone who was very comfortable in the woods. The forest was gorgeous, and the forest was ghastly. Ghastly because it was, for as far as you could see, a graveyard of vertically soaring trunks that had been shorn of every horizontal, every branch by the fire. For 5 days the previous October, the power fire, as it was called, it began near a power station, had roared across these mountains, consuming 17,000 acres of pine and cedar before a change in the wind direction allowed firefighters to contain it. The fire had been so fierce in places that it had vaporized whole trees. The only reason you knew this was because the flames, still ravenous for wood, had followed the trunks all the way down beneath the forest floor to consume the trees' roots, creating voids that reached deep into the earth. These blackened craters resembled molds that, were you to fill them with plaster, would yield a ghostly model of a pine tree's entire root system, accurate to the last detail. Not much lived in this desolate landscape. A handful of raptors, we heard owls, the occasional dazed squirrel, and here and there a fresh green spray of miner's lettuce that shocked the black ground. And yet if you achieved a slightly more aestheticized view of the scene, the same landscape exhibited a tranquil, almost modernist abstraction that was just beautiful. The dead straight black verticals ordered the hillsides as evenly as bristles on a brush, their steady rhythm varied every so often by a heavy black slash angled weirdly across the grid. The underlying shapes of the land, which was deeply creased into ravines gushing with snowmelt, had the explicitness of a line drawing, everything in view reduced to its formal essentials. But this was virtually the last time all day I lifted my gaze to take in the panorama. As soon as Ben announced he'd spotted his first morel, I began, exclusively and determinedly, looking down. There I found a thick carpet of pine needles amid the charred carcasses of pine. A morel resembles a tanned finger wearing a dark and deeply honeycombed dunce cap. They're a decidedly comic-looking mushroom, resembling leprechauns or little penises. The morel's distinctive form and patterning would make them easy to spot if not for their color, which ranges from dun to black and could not blend in more completely with a charred landscape. From a distance, the tiny stumps of burned saplings are easily mistaken for morels. So are the blackened pine cones, many of which stuck straight out of the ground like chubby thumbs and fooled you with their patterning, rhythmic like the morels. This was hard-looking, and for the first hour or so, every auspicious sighting turned out on closer inspection to be one or the other of these morel impostors. To help me get my eyes on, Ben, who by common consent had the best eyes on our team, began leaving in places patches of morels he'd found, so I could study them in situ, approaching a patch from various angles until I'd settled on the proper focal length and angle. The trigonometry of the gaze was everything, and I found that if I actually got down on the ground, which just below the layer of pine duff formed a mattress of sliding mud, I could see the little hats popping up here and there, morels that a moment before had been utterly invisible. When Ben spotted me hunting in a prone position, he approved. We say stop, drop, and roll because you can see things at ground level you'll never see from above. Ben and Anthony had a slew of these mushroom-hunting adages, and I collected them over the course of the day. Seeing is believing means you never see any mushrooms until someone else has demonstrated their presence by finding one. Mushroom frustration is what you feel when everyone around you is seeing them and you're still blind. Until that is, you find your first, thereby breaking your mushroom virginity. Then there's the clusterfuck, when your eyes are on and other hunters crowd you, hoping your good fortune will rub off. Clusterfucking, I was given to understand, was bad manners. And then there was the screensaver, the fact that after several hours interrogating the ground for little brown dunce caps, their images will be burned on your retinas. You'll see. When you get into bed tonight, Ben said, you'll shut your eyes and there they'll be again. Wall-to-wall morels. Anthony and Ben had dozens of theories about mushrooms, as well as a healthy appreciation for the limitations of all theories involving something as mysterious as mushrooms. They cataloged for me the indicator species for morels, other, more conspicuous plants and fungi that signaled their likely presence. Dogwood in bloom was a good sign that the soil had reached the proper temperature, as was allegedly the appearance of the ice plant, a big, bright red phallus rising up from the otherwise lifeless forest floor. However, there were no morels in the vicinity of the one ice plant I spotted. A tiny brown cup fungus was another indicator species that proved somewhat more reliable. Anthony and Ben were convinced the morels would appear at the same altitude in any given week, so wherever we wandered, we consulted the GPS to ascertain how high we were and tried to stay around 4,400 feet. I could see why you would want theories to organize your hunting. I'd worked up my own while hunting chanterelles with Angelo. There was so much ground to cover, and the morels were so damned quiet that theories helped divide the field on which we were playing this game of hide-and-seek into warmer and colder areas. The theories told you when to intensify your attention, scrupulously combing the forest floor with your eyes, and when you could safely rest it. For the hunter-gatherer, high-quality attentiveness is a precious but limited resource, and theories, by encapsulating past experience, help you to deploy it most efficiently. But you must never forget the final theory, the theory of all theories, Ben warned near the end of my morning tutorial. We call it TPITP. The proof is in the pudding. In other words, when hunting mushrooms, you should be prepared to jettison all previous theories and go with whatever seems to be working in this particular place at this particular time. Mushrooms behave unpredictably, and theories can go only so far in pushing back their mystery. It's not like gambling, Ben said. You're looking for the big score, the mother lode. The conditions might be perfect in every way, but you never know what you're going to find around the next bend. It could be a sea of mushrooms or nothing at all. The morning was spent wandering in more or less the same square mile or so, the four of us with our heads down, tracing utterly random patterns across the steep hillside, following trails of morels that went hot and cold. My gaze locked on a point about 6 steps in front of me, I'd completely lose track of my location in space and time. In this, mushroom hunting felt like a form of meditation.